Iran starts enriching uranium to 60% purity level at its Fordo facility. That in response to the IAEA's latest resolution. Yemeni armed forces say that they've stopped a foreign ship from stealing the nation's oil at a southern port. North Korea accuses the United Nations of adopting double a standard on weapons deployment after the Security Council meeting on its missile test. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Iran says it's started enriching uranium to 60% purity at its Fordo nuclear site. And that's a response to recent anti-Iran resolution by the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The measures outlined by the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran also include replacing the facility's centrifuges with advanced IR-6 machines. Two cascades of advanced centrifuges have also been installed at a separate site in Natanz. It's already enriching uranium to 60% purity. Iran says these are initial measures after the U.S. and three European countries got the anti-Iran resolution ratified in the IAEA on Thursday. It accuses Iran of lack of cooperation with the agency. Tehran has described the resolution as politically motivated. It's warning some Western countries are trying to hinder cooperation between Tehran and the U.N. agency. Journalist and activist Farah Hugh says that Iran has been transparent with the U.N. nuclear agency over its nuclear program.
Iran has been fully transparent all the way through this process. And we must remember that it was Donald Trump who withdrew from the JCPOA agreement. So America is basically at fault for the situation that we all find ourselves in today. I was doing a wee tiny bit of research there, and I mean, there are other countries in the region, specifically Israel, that is claimed to have had up to 400 nuclear weapons. So, you know, if Israel is allowed to have these weapons, which it refuses to declare, I think what we're witnessing is a further attack upon Iran's kind of opportunity to defend itself. Now, the Iranian government has said categorically that it is involved in peaceful enrichment of the uranium. And the idea behind this is that they can, you know, use medical equipment and this enriched uranium for other peaceful activities. With the usual suspects, actually, of America, Britain, Germany, and France, who kind of stand accused of being involved in these deadly terrorist attacks in Iran via the Kurds in Iraq. This is just another part of the ongoing undeclared war of Israel and the Western imperialists against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
The Belarusian Prime Minister Roman Kolachenko is in Iran on an official visit focusing on expansion of bilateral ties. The official was welcomed by Iran's first Vice President Mohammad Mukhber at Sadabad Palace a short while ago. He is heading a Rankin delegation during his one-day trip. Belarusian and Iran officials are set to discuss ways to enhance mutual cooperation in different fields, including agriculture, transit, and energy. Among other things, the visit follows agreements reached between Iranian and Belarusian presidents on the sidelines of a recent summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization held in the Uzbek capital, Tashkent. Russia urging Turkey to exercise restraint in using excessive military force in Syria, that after Ankara launched air raids against Kurdish militants in the country. Russian media cited an envoy to Syria saying that Moscow hopes to convince Ankara to prevent tensions on Syrian territory from escalating. Alexander Lavrentiev reportedly said that Russia would help settle what it called the Kurdish issue peacefully. On Sunday, Turkey conducted air strikes against bases of Kurdistan's Workers' Party, PKK, in Iraq, and their affiliate YPG in southeastern Syria. The offensive came days after a bomb hit Istanbul, leaving scores of casualties. Ankara blamed the PKK for the attack, but the Kurdish militants denied involvement. The Turkish president has also threatened to launch a ground offensive against Kurdish militants in Syria. The Yemeni army says it's thwarted an attempt by an enemy tanker to plunder the country's oil in the south. In a series of tweets, the Army spokesman said the ship was on a mission to steal enormous amounts of oil from the port of Al-Adaba. Yahya Sari added that the Yemeni armed forces adequately dealt with the ship after refusing to heed warnings. He also vowed that the Yemeni armed forces would continue to protect the country's resources. In recent weeks, Yemen says it's foiled at least two other attempts by the Saud-led coalition to loot its oil. Yemenis say that the Saud-led coalition looted more than $13 billion worth of the country's oil. Between 2016 and 2021, the coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Yusuf Mowry, says that the former Saudi-backed government in Yemen is behind the plunder of the country's oil.
Foreign companies, they seem to have contracts and deals in place with members of the Saudi-backed government, which basically sold these companies and these nations Yemeni oil below international market price. And the Saudi-backed Yemeni government is basically dependent on this revenue stream to make profit. And this hasn't been the case for the past month and a half, as the Ansar Allah movement continues to force these oil companies to churn back without any Yemeni oil. The Ansar Allah movement, as they mentioned, they believe that, you know, countries such as the U.S., the British government, and the UN, they're allowing this war to continue so that Yemen's natural resources continue to be extorted, so that Yemeni oil and Yemeni gas can continue to be plundered from the nation, right? And this was the case. This is a similar pattern that we've seen happen every time one of these nations launches a war on a country in the Middle East. We've seen this, you know, in Iraq, where a war was launched and the country's natural resources and oil was plundered from the country. We've seen this happen in Syria, and apparently, you know, this is also the case here in Yemen. And this has been happening for the past 8 years.
North Korea accusing the United Nations of adopting a double standard approach toward weapons development after the Security Council convened a meeting on the country's latest missile launch. Pyongyang described the meeting as a grave political provocation. It also vowed a strong response to anyone who takes issue with North Korea's sovereign rights. During the meeting, the U.S. and its allies slammed North Korea for its intercontinental ballistic missile test on Friday. The projectile landed about 200 kilometers from Japan's coastline. During the session, the test launch was labeled an unequivocal threat to international peace and security, but the Council failed to adopt a resolution amid opposition by Russia and China. North Korea has tested a blitz of missiles in recent months in response to joint military drills by the United States and South Korea. A short while ago, we were joined by our Seoul correspondent, Frank Smith, and he says North Korea has been conducting missile tests in reaction to U.S. military exercises on the Korean Peninsula.
We shouldn't be surprised that North Korea reacted this way with Kim Yo-jong, that's Kim Jong-un's sister, coming out and really criticizing the United Nations Security Council for its double standards and condemning North Korea for its recent ICBM tests. North Korea's recent missile tests this year need to be put into perspective. In South Korea, you have a new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who's vowed to strengthen his alliance with the United States. And he's initiated the resumption of large-scale military exercises, U.S.-South Korea joint military drills. The largest land-based drills in 5 years took place in late summer, and the largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea Air Force drills wrapped up just a couple of weeks ago. Putting this all in perspective, then, it can be understood North Korea's testing of missiles and development of a nuclear deterrent can be a little bit better understood, especially, again, considering 28,500 U.S. troops are here in South Korea.
The Chinese defense minister says that Taiwan is at the center of the country's core interests and a red line that the U.S. should not cross. Wei Fenghe says that the issue has nothing to do with external forces and is for the Chinese people to decide. Made a comment in a meeting with his American counterpart, Lloyd Austin, and stressed that the U.S. is committed to the One China policy and opposed to unilateral changes to Taiwan's status quo. Austin also raised concerns about what are called increasingly dangerous behavior by Chinese military aircraft in the Indo-Pacific region. The two powers are at loggerheads over their military activities and Taiwan, which China considers as part of its territory. The tension over Taiwan have increased since the U.S. House Speaker visited the island in August. According to volunteer groups, a growing number of people are turning to food banks in Spain as soaring inflation pushes food prices even higher.
Lately, yes, the number of families is increasing a lot, especially since the war in Ukraine and the drastic rise that has caused inflation, because we are noticing that in the association, every Saturday about 15, 20 new families come to us to sign up because they're in great need. Many young people who wanted to start businesses and have a working career right now have had to close their businesses, and from being our donors, they've become our recipients.
One in seven households in Spain is suffering from food insecurity due to low income. According to the National Statistics Institute, food prices were 15.4% higher in October from a year before. To ease the pressure on the households, the government has introduced subsidies for transport, a one-off payment of 200 euros for the unemployed, and a 15% increase in pensions for the most vulnerable. But charities that work with the poor say that the measures are not enough. Europe is reeling from the economic shockwaves of the war in Ukraine that has led to a surge in inflation and energy costs. Russia says that Ukrainian forces keep shelling the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in southern Ukraine, warning of a nuclear disaster.
The Kiev regime continued its provocations aimed at the creation of a man-made disaster at Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. On November 21st, the Ukrainian artillery fired eight large-caliber projectiles targeting plant's industrial zone.
The Russian Defense Ministry spokesman says that the plant was shelled from its settlement in Dnipropetrovsk region controlled by Ukrainian forces. The revelation comes just days after similar strikes caused widespread damage to Europe's biggest nuclear plant. Kiev and Moscow, however, have been accusing each other for shelling. Meantime, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency has condemned the attacks, saying that these risk a major humanitarian disaster. In a statement, Rafael Grossi called for a safe zone around the plant. Moscow says there is no substantial progress toward creating such a zone. The Ukrainians are bracing for a harsh winter as Russian strikes cripple the country's power capacity. Temperatures are already below freezing in several areas, including in capital Kiev. President Volodymyr Zelensky is urging the people to conserve electricity. He says half of the country's power capacity has been knocked out by Russian rockets. A major energy provider has said that millions of Ukrainians are most likely to live with blackouts until the end of March. On Thursday, a barrage of Russian missiles hit several Ukrainian cities, including Kiev. Local officials say that many of such attacks hit the energy infrastructure. Let's now get some more details about the situation in Ukraine from our correspondent, Danyask, John Miller.
Well, yes, for the last few weeks now, Russia has been hitting energy infrastructure all across Ukraine. Many were confused why Russia didn't start doing that in February, but now they certainly are. And the situation for ordinary Ukrainians is getting drastically worse very quickly, especially as winter is starting to set in. One Ukrainian official suggested that any Ukrainians should try and leave the country for winter. Of course, men of military age can't do that. Emergency blackouts being announced right across Ukraine. And one of the most absurd pieces of propaganda from the start of this conflict is that the idea that Russia is running out of missiles. They're clearly not. We can expect more barrages in the coming days or weeks by Russia. And so Ukrainian people are continuing to suffer. Russia's strategy in this, it also damages Ukraine's ability to mobilize, send its troops to different parts of the front line that is hundreds of kilometers long. But it also is increasing the suffering of the Ukrainian people. And Russia's strategy is to try to make it impossible for Ukraine to carry on this war. So it's not able to look after the most basic needs of its people and therefore forcing them to the negotiating table. Here in Donetsk, in Donbass, where I am, there's no problems with heating or electricity. There is problems with water, but people here are suffering as well. And of course, in Europe, on a wider level, many Europeans are going to be suffering this winter with extraordinarily high energy bills.
Rescue operations are underway to find people still trapped in the rubble after a devastating earthquake hit Indonesia's West Java province. The death toll from the 5.6 magnitude quake standing at 252. Some 300 others also injured. Most of the victims are children because they were at school when the quake hit. The tremor has damaged at least 2,000 homes, displacing thousands of people. Indonesia is located on the so-called Pacific Ring of Fire, an epicenter for deadly quakes. One of such disasters in 2021 killed more than 100 people in the country's Sulawesi Island. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Security services, the fake Israeli regime, and certain Western politicians that have engineered plots to spark a civil war, destroy and break up Iran, must know that Iran is neither Libya nor Sudan. That was what Iran's foreign minister tweeted recently. Abdullahian said that Iran's enemies have their eyes set on Iran's territorial integrity and identity, accusing Israel and Western intelligence services of plotting to start civil war in the Islamic Republic. The statements were confirmed by a leaked audio from a presenter at UK's state-funded news channel, BBC Persian. Abdullahian had good reason to relay those sentiments. The statements came on the heels of a number of terrorist attacks in the Islamic Republic. One took place in Izeh, in the southwestern province of Khuzestan, killing seven people, including a nine-year-old boy and woman. The other took place in Isfahan, in which terrorists attacked security forces and killed three of them. There's a vicious anti-Iran media campaign led by terrorist media outlets like the Saudi-funded Iran International, which are twisting the truth and are accusing Iranian security forces of committing the terrorist acts. This stage of the anti-Iran plot is called an armed one, something that the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton warned about. He claimed that subversive elements in Iran, which he dubbed as the opposition, were arming themselves with weapons stolen from besieged forces and smuggled from Iraq's Kurdistan. This was evident when an uptick in the number of security forces killed were reported during 3 days, from November 15th through November 18th. During this period, 14 security forces were reported to have been victims of terrorist attacks. The terrorist killings in Izeh, Isfahan, and Mashhad, which followed a recent similar attack against pilgrims and worshippers at the shrine of Shah Cheragh in Shiraz, also showed that the enemy plots have failed, and they are now subscribing to terrorist acts involving firearms and weapons. Iran has blasted the silence of the international community over the recent terrorist attacks. It blamed foreign powers for promoting and encouraging violence and terrorism. Further said that their silence is testament to that, saying undoubtedly the international silence of claimants of human rights and foreign promoters of chaos and violence in Iran in the face of the most blatant terrorist operations in a number of Iranian cities conveys no other message than encouragement of terrorism and the promotion of terrorism across the world. The Iranian city of Mashhad. Funeral processions were held for three besieged volunteer force members who were stabbed to death by rioters earlier this week. The turnout in the tens of thousands. Iran's leader has stated that they are trying to give the impression that large numbers of people are opposed to the Islamic establishment in order to impress ignorant individuals. However, the leader noted that the people's mass presence on stage to safeguard the Islamic revolution amounts to a slap in the face of ill-wishers. That became even more evident when the following day in Isfahan, again, people showed up in large numbers, tens of thousands, to pay their last respects to the victims while condemning all acts of violence and terror. Putting these scenes next to each other, there is no comparison. The Saudi-funded Iran International depiction of what is happening in Iran is far from reality, to the point that the channel, which Iran has named a terrorist entity, is actively promoting and encouraging not only acts of violence, but is under the delusional impression that there is a revolution underway in Iran. The scenes, when put next to each other, speak for themselves.
For weeks, Iran has witnessed unrest and riots in its different cities. The unrest started after a young woman named Mahsa Amini fainted in police custody and later died in hospital. The protests were initially peaceful, but violent elements supported by Western spy agencies hijacked the protests and turned into violent riots. The unrest has provided the fertile ground for Western governments and spy agencies to launch a media warfare on Iran and create anti-Iran fake news. A recent notorious case in point is the recent tweet by Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. In the controversial tweet, the Canadian Premier had claimed that Iran has sentenced 15,000 protesters to death. The false claim, which has been part of the media campaign against Iran, has been circulating on social media in recent days. The inaccurate tweet was live on Trudeau's official Twitter account for almost 12 hours before it was deleted. Several Western celebrities and news outlets, including the Newsweek, also shared the erroneous information. This is not the only case of false news propagated against Iran. When the protests first started in Iran, Western-backed propaganda outlets claimed that Mahsa Amini was beaten to death by Iranian police forces. Following an elaborate investigation, that claim also proved to be false. It's now become a common practice for these propaganda machines to publish unverified footages on protests in Iran. Back in September 2022, U.S. media outlets ran a controversial report. The report was widely discussed and celebrated in anti-Iran outlets. But it turned out to be a fake report after Ayatollah Khamenei publicly attended a military ceremony in Tehran in October. The false report was propagated by Western outlets as Iran was battling the Western-backed riots. Social media platforms have also turned into a battleground of narratives against Iran. Analysis shows those tweeting the hashtags associated with the unrest showed a striking number of new accounts created since the protests started.
In August 2011, when there were riots in London because someone was shot and killed by the police, a number of people were killed. I don't recall the exact number. But big tech, Facebook, back then BlackBerry, and Twitter cooperated with the British government. In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments, even though in the riots in London, people were killed, okay, and they arrested people and put them in jail for inciting riots. But in Iran, these same media outlets make threats, they support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the rioters.
The online anti-Iran campaign is fed by fake accounts used by members of the anti-Iran Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization terrorist cult who are stationed in Albania and so-called journalists employed by the Saudi-funded London-based Iran International TV, which is now on Tehran's terror blacklist. The television channel has openly been promoting monarchists, the highly notorious MKO terror group, and most significantly, separatist terrorists. A particular case in point is a project by Western media outlets to accuse the government of killing its own citizens. They have produced a long list of citizens which they claim have been killed by security forces.
Iran has witnessed another deadly terrorist attack. The latest deadly incident happened in the city of Izeh in Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan. Unidentified gunmen opened fire on civilians and security forces, killing several people, including a child and an elderly woman. The terror attack also left a number of people injured. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the assault. President Ebrahim Raisi has condoled with the families of the victims, ordering security officials to identify and bring to justice all terrorists behind the attack. A senior judicial official says three people who were behind the brutal attack were arrested. A special operation is going on to identify and to bring to justice other people involved in the attack in the city of Izeh. Separately, a religious seminary school in the Izeh city was set ablaze by a group of rioters. No one was injured in that incident. Separately, three people were killed and eight security forces injured during riots in Semirom in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. Two security forces also killed and two others wounded in the city of Malikshahr in Isfahan province. Last month, a terrorist attack happened in the city of Shiraz. On October 26th, a terrorist attacked the popular Shia shrine of Shah Cheragh in Iran's southwestern province of Fars, killing over a dozen people. That attack was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. The attacks come amid ongoing foreign-backed riots that have hit various Iranian provinces after a 22-year-old Kurdish woman named Mahsa Amini died in the hospital despite intensive medical care and resuscitation efforts. The rioters have been going on a rampage across the country, attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism against public property, and desecrating religious sanctities. Iran says the attacks are part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian says security services, the Israeli regime, and certain Western politicians are conspiring to trigger a civil war in Iran to destroy and to disintegrate the country. He warned them that Iran is not Libya or Sudan. He also noted that the enemies are targeting Iran's territorial integrity and identity, saying that Iran will not allow anyone to jeopardize national security. The terrorist attack comes amid Western attempts to stoke unrest in Iran and to create more economic hardships for the Iranian people. Late last month, Iran's main intelligence bodies reported that the U.S., backed by the U.K., Saudi Arabia, Israel, and other allies, are devising a multidimensional plot for instigating riots in the Islamic Republic and directing the wave of violence.
We are telling our enemies, the U.S., Britain, the Saudis, these are the ones that, through their destructive media outlets, they are targeting our revolution. We are warning them. that we will break you, we will crush you, you will not find any way into this territory.
Western countries expressed their open support for rioters and acts that Tehran described as inciting violence and hatred. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the recent riots. Recently, the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton confirmed that subversive groups in Iran, which he characterized as the opposition, are being armed with weapons imported from Iraq's Kurdistan.
United States should take history as a mirror and let it guide the future. That's what the Chinese President Xi Jinping told his American counterpart Joe Biden on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit in Bali, Indonesia.
As always, I'm ready to have a candid and in-depth exchange of views with Mr. President on issues of strategic importance in China-US relations and major global and regional issues at our meeting today. I also look forward to working with you to bring China-US relations back to the track of healthy and stable development.
We share responsibility, in my view, to show that China and the United States can manage our differences, prevent competition from becoming anything ever near conflict, and to find ways to work together on urgent global issues that require our mutual cooperation.
The two held their first ever in-person meeting as relations between Washington and Beijing are at their lowest in decades, marred by disagreements over a host of issues from Taiwan to trade. During the landmark three-hour meeting, the Chinese president warned his U.S. counterpart not to cross Beijing's red line over Taiwan. According to the Chinese state media, Xi stressed that Taiwan is the bedrock of the political foundation of bilateral relations. Biden, for his part, said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming conflict. Biden said he sought to assure Xi that U.S. policy on Taiwan has not changed, seeking to lower tensions over the self-ruled island.
And I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all. It's the same exact position we've had. I made it clear that we want to see cross-strait issues peacefully resolved.
On North Korea, Biden told Xi that Beijing has an obligation to attempt to talk Pyongyang out of conducting a seventh nuclear test. U.S.-China relations have been strained in recent years by growing tensions over issues ranging from Taiwan to the South China Sea, trade practices and U.S. restrictions on Chinese technology. Regarding Taiwan, Beijing says it's a matter for the Chinese and China's internal affair. Anyone that seeks to split Taiwan from China will be violating the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation. Tensions over the self-ruled island have intensified following a provocative visit there in August by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The move prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory as well as a declaration by the U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing has time and again slammed U.S. provocations, including encouraging and supporting pro-separatist independence forces on the island, saying that Washington has no right to interfere in how to resolve the Taiwan issue. Also, Biden dropped the hammer on China's semiconductor industry by fully implementing a slew of tough controls on the export of American chip technology to China. It would also undermine China's ability to import, manufacture, and export the semiconductors that run the world. The goal was to slow down and prevent Chinese military and technological advances. Washington also takes sides with Beijing's rivals in a maritime dispute in the South China Sea, by routinely sending warships and warplanes to the waters to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation. China has repeatedly called on Washington to stop the provocative actions, which undermine peace and stability in the strategic waters. Last month, the White House and the Pentagon declared Beijing as Washington's most serious strategic competitor, in reports outlining U.S. defense and foreign policy strategies. Therefore, despite Biden's meeting with Xi, can the two manage their differences to prevent conflict? Or is it inevitable that the two are on the collision course?
ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
أم كيف يتقلقل بين أطباقها وأنت تعلم صدقا أم كيف تزجره زبانيتها وهو يناديك يا رب أم كيف يرجو فضلك في عتقه منها فتتركه فيها مشبه لما عملت به الموحدين من برك وإحسانك.
Brothers and sisters, as Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, in this part says, everyone should be hopeful of the mercy of the Almighty Allah. أم كيف يتقلقل بين أطباقها وأنت تعلم صدقه. How should he be convulsed among the levels of fire while you know his sincerity? أَمْ كَيْفَ تَزْجُرُهُ زَبَانِيَتُهَا وَهُوَ يُنَادِيكَ يَا رَبَّهُ. How should its keepers torture him while he calls out to you, O Lord? أَمْ كَيْفَ يَرْجُو فَضْلَكَ فِي عَتْقِهِ مِنْهَا فَتَتْرُكُهُ فِيهَا. How should he have hope of your bounty in freeing him from the fire while you abandon him there within it? Hayat, far be it from you. As we clarified in the previous episodes, the reality of supplication is ontological need toward Allah, understanding and perceiving it, and in the last level, presenting it before the Almighty Allah. In this part of the Kumail supplication, as we see, this da'f and this ontological need, this weakness, is named by Imam Ali alayhi salam to attract the mercy of Almighty Allah more. We human beings disobey Allah and commit sins. But the very wrong deeds we commit seek the forgiveness of Allah by means of prayer and asking. And at times even without that. But this is so long as the servant does not rebel against his master. This is as long as he does not become stone-hearted and strong-headed, such that he is driven away from the mercy of Allah. The Holy Quran says, قُلْ يَا عِبَادِيَ الَّذِينَ أَسْرَفُوا عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِهِمْ. Say, my servants who have committed excesses against their own souls. لا تقنطوا من رحمة الله. Do not despair of the mercy of Allah. إن الله يغفر الذنوب جميعا. Indeed, Allah forgives all sins. And the verse continues, indeed, He is the all-forgiving, the all-merciful. هو الغفور الرحيم. This is the kind of mercy Imam Ali alayhi salam is attracting in this part of the song.
My Lord, then how could he remain in torment when he hopefully relies upon your past forbearance, compassion and mercy? And how can the fire cause him suffering when he hopes for your grace and mercy? And how can its roaring flames shower him when you hear his voice and see his plight?
Thank you, Allah, let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So as we mentioned and clarified, the relation exists between the need, the ontological need that we all have in ourselves, and the mercy of Allah. And this relation, which exists between the forgiveness and mercy from Allah, and our sins and disobedience, as we explained before the break, between the power of Allah and our weakness, between His self-sufficiency and our poverty, between the cure He grants us and our illness, between His salvation and our being in need of Him desperately, between His knowledge and our ignorance, and our exceeding the limits set by Him, even without there being a request, even without there being a demand and understanding from our side, even without there being a prayer and supplication, is to be considered as one of the secrets of Islam. And it really is. It is among the secrets of this universe and the laws that govern this universe. Unless man understands this law in the universe and comprehends it within the context of his relation with Allah, he will not be able to understand major parts of the teachings of this religion. He won't be even close to be having an understanding of the teachings of Islam. How many a sick have been cured by Allah's mercy without demand and prayer? The Holy Quran says, وَإِذَا مَرِضْتُ فَهُوَ يَشْفِينَ. When I get sick, it is He who cures me. There is no other thing involved here. There is no asking and demanding, as the verse says. This mere thing of being marid, being sick, attracts His cure, attracts His mercy. وَإِذَا مَرِضْتُ فَهُوَ يَشْفِينَ. How many a needy and hungry, whom Allah provided without them asking and praying to Allah? How many a helpless in the depth of the oceans, or beneath the rubbles, under the swords, or amidst the burning fire, has been embraced by the mercy of Allah and have been rescued without asking and imploring Him? I mean, when we refer to ourselves, we see lots of these things happening around us, and even for ourselves. How many times we've been in different difficulties and challenges, and we have been delivered without even thinking about the Almighty Allah, without even bringing Him to our mind and asking Him. Now, see what happens if we have Him in our mind, and if we try to talk to Him and refer to Him only in our supplications and du'as. This is another aspect of this part of the Divine Kumail supplication. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, Take care and goodbye.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be the most close to you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we spoke on Saddam's invasion to Iran at the behest of his masters in Washington and also discussed Imam Khomeini's reaction to this. Today we are going to dwell upon the election of Abul Hassan Bani Sadr as the first president of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the events leading to his dismissal. Stay tuned, please. Nearly 8 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and 70 sessions of the Assembly of Experts, the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran was prepared and finally was ratified by the Iranian nation in a referendum in December 1979. A few days later, the enrollment for the candidates of presidential election started and 8 candidates were introduced to the people to run for the election. The elections were held in a fervent atmosphere, and Abul Hassan Bani Sadr garnered 75% of the votes, nearly 11 million votes, and was elected as the first president of the new Islamic system. Then, in early February 1980, he took oath of loyalty to the constitution at the presence of Imam Khomeini, and some of the officials and Imam endorsed his presidency. Then Imam Khomeini, in a short speech, advised Bani Sadr to take care of his morals after being elected as president. Bani Sadr had to introduce his cabinet members to the parliament, but this was delayed due for a few months, as the parliament had not been formed yet. Finally, in July 1980, he took oath in front of the lawmakers as the president of Iran and said that he would soon introduce his premier for appointment of ministers. Bani Sadr introduced a few figures whom were rejected due to certain reasons. Then a council was held to solve the differences between the president and the parliament. And finally, Muhammad Ali Rajai was introduced as the prime minister, although Bani Sadr was at odds with Rajai, owing to the latter's full obedience of Imam Khomeini. The differences between Bani Sadr and Rajoy lingered, and these differences culminated in introduction of the cabinet members as, according to the constitution, it was the prime minister who would do the job and then the president would approve them to be introduced to the parliament for the vote of trust. Muhammad Ali Rajoy consulted with the prominent figures of the Islamic Revolution and at last determined the list for the cabinets. However, the list was rejected by the president as he emphasized on compliance with the president as the criterion for choosing of cabinet members. But the imam stressed mutual comprehension, which led to the reduction of tension, and the cabinet was finally held. Nevertheless, the differences between the prime minister and the president increased day by day, and they spread to other areas, such as the authority of the president in decision over the fate of the American hostages, the administration of the war, and other issues. During this tense climate in the country, a commission was held to act as the arbiter between the president and the premier. The commission had a representative from Imam Khomeini too, but Bani Sadr would not accept the decision of the commission, although he had a representative in it. Due to betrayal and malfeasance in the war and various issues, Bani Sadr was introduced as guilty, and then Imam Khomeini dismissed him as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, though he stressed that Bani Sadr had to continue his presidential responsibilities. During those tough conditions, the parliament, after lengthy debates, voted for the political disqualification of Bani Sadr, in which 170 MPs voted in favor of the bill. As a result, Bani Sadr was deposed of presidency. Thus, he tried to draw his fans to the streets, but Imam Khomeini's harsh stance against him and his supporters in his party nipped his efforts in the bud. Therefore, Bani Sadr was ousted from presidency and a few days later, he escaped from the country. He was accompanied by the criminal ringleader of the MKO terrorist outfit, Masoud Rajavi. Both of them were disguised as women, not to be recognized.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.